Hello and welcome. The Portavoot Institute for the Study of the Iranian World welcomes you to another episode of our podcast, Legacies of Ancient Persia. Join us as we further explore the many legacies of ancient Persia and its relevance to global patrimony. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Legacies of Ancient Persia. This week, I sat down with my colleague, Dr. Marissa Stevens, who is the assistant director of the Portavoot Institute and an Egyptologist. In this episode, we discuss how she developed an interest in cross-cultural interactions via her work with 21st Dynasty Egyptian funerary papyri, her hopes for expanding Egypt-Persia projects and working at the Portavoot Institute, and about the types of future outreach initiatives the Portavoot could produce for the general public. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give our show a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify. Awesome. Okay, Marissa, thanks for joining me. Been pretty excited to get this one underway. And I want to start you off and just say, you know, tell us how you got into ancient Egypt, the ancient world more broadly.
Oh, okay. The ancient world and ancient Egypt. I always tell people that I just never grew up, because if you had asked me when I was 8 years old what I wanted to be, I would have said an Egyptologist. I feel like most students go through, or most children go through, a phase where it's like ancient history or dinosaurs or space, right? It's always kind of one of those things. And for me, it was ancient history, and I never grew out of it. And I very fortunately had teachers that always encouraged me and parents that always encouraged me and never said, "That's silly. That's not a real job. You can't do that." They always said, "All right, if this is it, make sure it's it. Figure out what you need to do and get it done."
And was that pretty easy, pretty hard? Did you have resources available to you that would make this easier, or not really?
Well, I mean, looking back, I suppose I didn't have a lot of resources, but I really utilized those that I had. Right. So I remember my parents would always be looking into additional school programming, summer school programming of some kind. Local universities often offered day camp kind of activities for kids in the summer, especially, you know, to experience a college campus, take a little mini college class. So I did that in my early teens a lot. Always taking me to libraries and museums, all of that kind of stuff. So I really capitalized on what was available. And the more I did, the more I fell in love with it.
And were you always dead set on Egypt, or did you open yourself up to maybe doing something a little more interdisciplinary? Or did you, let's say the third way, right, is maybe wanting to do Egypt and being dead set on it, but also saying, "I'll do interdisciplinary stuff within Egypt"?
I think all the interdisciplinary stuff came later. I was always pretty focused on Egypt. I always thought it was so interesting, so fascinating, everything from the mummies and the pyramids, that, you know, that's what first captivates you as a kid. And then I think at some point you realize these are real people with a full-fledged civilization that is nuanced and messy and intricate. And they had the same motivations and desires and fears and goals that we do today. And to try to untangle how they navigated their world and how that can impact how we view ourselves and navigate our own world was kind of what kept me interested. You know, as I grew into it and I learned more, that's when I realized, oh, I think there's something here with studying the ancient past. And that's, I think, where the interdisciplinarity comes in, right? When you realize all societies have something to contribute, and it's not just one singular group of people that are in this bubble and they're insulated. It's everybody in the ancient worlds working together and being able to compare that and contrast that and see that bigger picture is incredibly important.
Nice. Did you, I mean, I know you got your PhD here at UCLA, and they do have a lot of resources here, as we both know. So, you know, at that point, were you interested and able to take classes outside of Egypt and see how it would tie back to your research? Or, you know, was there just so much to do within your own discipline that you sort of had to focus on that?
I think the majority of your coursework, especially when you get to the PhD, is hyper-focused. But I think it's always important to have that element of your studies that is broader and bigger picture and can incorporate both the knowledge and the skills of other experts, you know, and get their perspective. So I always tried to look for classes and take classes that had some sort of comparative element or a theoretical component that could also apply to Egypt, even if the class itself wasn't about Egypt. And so the one I'm thinking of was, in particular, was a class called The Construction of Value in the Ancient World. And it was led by John Papadopoulos and focused not just on any one society, but looking at how different civilizations constructed value, right? How they looked at different objects, commodified objects, ascribed value, whether that's economic value, symbolic value, religious value, social value, to different object types, different materials, and really focused on the theories in which we can study all of these different objects that are left to us in the archaeological record. And one great thing about that class was that we actually took it at the Getty, and it was open to all UC students, not just UCLA students. So we had Getty resources as well as a UCLA instructor, and we got to bridge connections between all of our other UC schools and meet additional students who we otherwise would have never met, and got their insight. And so classes like that, I think, are incredibly valuable.
Yeah, I wish I had a class like that, but alas, resources are quite limited in mid-Missouri, so can't always choose what we want. But yeah, so I mean, I guess for the listeners who maybe are approaching this from the more Iranian side and don't know as much about Egyptology, I mean, there's no doubt that, you know, both of these fields are not huge, right? But for someone who doesn't really know much about Egyptology, you know, is the field bigger? I feel, just because I feel like you're more likely within the limited scope to find stuff about Egypt than you are about Iran.
Right. I mean, I don't really know if it's bigger. I think it might feel bigger to me, but only maybe because I know it more and I knew it first. But it wouldn't surprise me, like you said, especially when it comes to the material available, you know, because of the restrictions regarding travel to modern Iran and sanctions involving modern Iran in these past decades, I think it has deterred perhaps somewhat the study of that ancient society. And it is certainly limited the amount of correspondence that we can have with our Iranian scholars in Iran today. And that is hugely detrimental to the field when you have a whole group of people and their collective knowledge that are sometimes untouchable for you. And, you know, I often wonder, you know, especially with younger scholars in Iranian studies just starting out, you know, I always think kind of in the back of my head, oh, you picked a field where you might not ever get there. You know, and I hope I'm wrong. I hope the situation changes soon. But that must be so hard to feel like you're missing one of the central puzzle pieces in that obtaining firsthand experience of being there and seeing those sites, getting to walk Persepolis, getting to see the Bisatun inscriptions. That must be a huge challenge for them. And they're finding very creative ways of overcoming those challenges, from digital archives and online resources and and all of that. But I think that has limited the growth and the popularity somewhat, perhaps, of Iranian studies. But if you're committed to finding that material, it exists and there's a wealth of it, and it is fascinating and detailed and beautiful and worth studying.
For sure. Well, I mean, obviously, with the limited resources you were just alluding to, it would probably make some people hesitate to go right into the field, the proper field of Iranian studies. And yeah, so I feel like you're right. It would make people maybe go to something adjacent and then try to approach it that way. So, as I tell people all the time, as a classics major, I somehow was not given any class or formal anything on the Persian side, which I don't really understand how that's possible, but I guess. So from the Egyptological side, how much crossover is there with Persia? How much can you see that there would be? I mean, obviously we know that at one time Egypt was sort of a satrap of the Persian Empire, but yeah, so just approaching it right from a different perspective, how much crossover do you see?
I mean, sadly, not a lot. So you're right that Egypt fell under the control of the Achaemenid Persian Empire technically twice, once in the 27th dynasty, Egypt's 27th dynasty, and the second in Egypt's 31st dynasty. There was a small chunk of history there where the Persians did lose control of Egypt and there was some native rule. And then once again, they came in towards the end of the Achaemenid period. And you would think that would be studied in detail in Egyptology. But sadly, a lot of traditional Egyptologists kind of view everything after the New Kingdom as what I jokingly call post-interesting. So they kind of want to cut off Egyptian history after the end of Egypt's New Kingdom. So, after you get Tutankhamun and Ramses the Great, all of these famous pharaohs that take up the bulk of publications and the bulk of media. Suddenly, then everything later is not as grand, not as good, not as high quality. If you're looking at material culture and art, those are kind of the impressions that people have. But I mean, it's simply not true. The wealth of material from Egypt's third intermediate period and late period is incredible, and the quality of the artwork, the quality of the inscriptions, the creativity of the literature, all of this, I think, is only enhanced by the fact that you suddenly have Egypt on an international stage and no longer necessarily the superpower in the picture, but someone that is being overtaken by these other groups, the Assyrians, the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, right? It's only going to create different layers of culture, different layers of society and social understanding. It's going to make it messy for sure. And I think a lot of scholars don't like that necessarily, that suddenly it's messy and you have to untangle a lot of different groups of people with different motivations, different languages, different backgrounds, different art styles, all of this. But to me, that's what makes things very interesting, is that you now have different groups having to negotiate their own identity on this international platform where everyone is suddenly in much greater competition than you see during the earlier time periods of Egyptian history.
I'm going to bring it back around, I promise. So bear with me on this small side journey we're about to take. But for you personally, in your academic career, why did you choose to go into the later stuff when it's maybe not as glamorous as doing, the Great Pyramids of Giza or, Ramesses or even Akhenaten, right? Amarna, everyone's like, oh, that's the interesting part. So why did you personally go later?
So I came to UCLA with very broad and abstract research questions. I knew I was interested in social identity. I knew I was interested in trying to navigate that identity, trying to define that identity and carve space for oneself during times of crisis and decentralization. That to me was super interesting. Just as a human question, how do we do that in turn when things are going bad, when things are not stable, what do we as human view to be at the core of our identity? And how do we try to preserve that and perpetuate that? And I mean, that answer is going to be different for everyone, right? And it's kind of different even on an individual level. But you can look to different groups in society. Maybe it's a religion that you're going to focus on. Maybe it's a language that is endangered and you will want to try to preserve that language. Maybe you turn to food, right? And it's the food of your culture that you try to preserve and you focus on as somehow becoming meaningful to you and a part of your social identity. So I had that question, and that's what I brought to UCLA. And I told my advisor, Kara Cooney, this is what I want to study. How do I do that? And now there's no scarcity of materials from Egypt to work on. And Kara was working on 21st dynasty coffins. And she said, well, you know, with these coffins, I really feel like I'm starting to kind of get to know these people almost on a personal level. There's so much information about these priests from Thebes that were buried in these particular coffins. And she said, you know, there's a lot of papyri that are also owned by these priests that were part of their burial. And the papyri have even more information about them and their positions within the temple and their family and all of this biographical information. Why don't you look at those? And at first I was a little hesitant. I didn't think I would be that great with language. I thought, oh, this is maybe too much. But it sort of just fell into place. And it just so happened that these papyri were from the 21st dynasty, the start of Egypt's third intermediate period, the time when we first start to see this type of crisis and decentralization occurring in society, where the king is not as powerful as he once was. And so people are turning to different modes of identification in this time period, namely the temple, to self-identify and perpetuate that social identity and that family identity. And so I got to address my big picture research question with this data set that just happened to be from this later period of Egyptian history. And I really liked it and kind of got stuck in that time period and a little bit later because of that.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I love it. And it's great that you were able to get sort of perfectly positioned and work on material that maybe a lot of other Egyptologists wouldn't necessarily want to.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but also I would say, you know, that positioned you in a very unique place where working in that later period, you get to see what happens, right? When Egypt is no longer able to be its singular little bubble down at the bottom of the Mediterranean, mm-hmm. when it's got to open up or when it gets conquered or when things happen. And so, I mean, do you feel that this has given you a unique sort of angle in which to approach, you know, interdisciplinary work with things like the Achaemenids?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that this was the perfect time period to start with, to see that happen, how you said things really opening up in the ancient world. It's not that we don't have interconnectedness earlier in Egyptian history or earlier in Near Eastern history. But it's really after the collapse of the Bronze Age that we start to see this international stage develop. There's an international art style that a lot of scholars reference. And, you know, communication spreads much more broadly during that time period than we see earlier. So it really was, I think, the perfect platform to look at these even later periods of Egyptian history.
And I mean, because of this unique positioning, I'm curious, and I hope our listeners are too, like, did this sort of lucky positioning also kind of influence your decision to work here at the Portavoot Institute?
Yeah, you know, I think it did. I think if I had been working on an earlier period of Egyptian history, number one, I don't know if I would have been as appealing a candidate to work for the Portavoot Institute. And I don't know if I would have had as great an interest as well. And so I think it was the perfect combination of me looking at this at the time newly developing center. I started at the Port of Ubud Center right after it was inaugurated at UCLA. And I thought, well, this is a position where I can relate my own research interests tangentially in a very small way, right? Because the intersection of ancient Egypt and ancient Persia during this small part of the Achaemenid period is just a drop in the bucket of Iranian history, right? But I saw that connection and I thought, well, I will be able to contribute intellectually in my own small way. And seeing a center develop around Iranian studies really impressed me because it is, a narrow field when you think about the study of the ancient worlds, to focus resources and attention on a singular civilization is not something many schools are able to achieve. I came from an ELK department, which in and of itself is quite rare, a department of Near Eastern languages and cultures that focuses on ancient Egypt, ancient Persia, the rest of the ancient Near East, Nubia, Northern Africa, Anatolia, right? All of these areas. And that is quite unique for a university to have enough resources just to focus on that portion of the world and not lump that into something even bigger, like all ancient world studies or just a general history department, right? So I was quite intrigued with the idea of working at an institution that could foster such dedicated academic research.
Yeah, I mean, I think that based on how you've positioned yourself, right, as you were very concentrated on Egypt, Egypt is your thing. That is in your heart of hearts what you love to do. And so it's interesting. And I've been asked once or twice, oh, I hear your colleague is an Egyptologist. So what's she doing working, with ancient Persia? And so I feel like, this is not an uncommon reaction. And so how exciting, and I'm hoping you can talk a little about your involvement with the Egyptian Consortium project that you're working on here, because I feel like when I have mentioned it to people, they've been quite shocked, right, that there is something like that here when we're not really Egypt focused.
Right. Well, I mean, the Achaemenid Egypt is very understudied, especially from the position of Egyptology. And so part of the center or the institute now, I mentioned that I started when it was a center and we're now an institute, the first institute of the Division of Humanities at UCLA. So part of the institute wants to focus on this understudied area. And probably it wouldn't have happened if they hadn't hired an Egyptologist, but I'm trying to build and with my colleague Dr. Jonathan Winterman, trying to build a structure that can allow scholars of Achaemenid Egypt, both on the Iranian studies side of things and the Egyptology side, to work together to study the monuments, the material culture, and the texts of Achaemenid Egypt. This is not something that has been very thoroughly documented in recent decades. Earlier publications from the 1930s have documented texts, have oftentimes ignored the materiality of those texts, the objects in which on which those texts are, whether they're temples or statuary. And other publications have focused on the objects themselves, but not necessarily the text so much, right? So we're looking to kind of build a more holistic picture of what does this evidence truly tell us in terms of excavation history, in terms of textuality, in terms of materiality. And so that's the goal. So we've been reaching out to a number of colleagues. They've all been very excited, very supportive of the project, and asking, what would your primary goal be, right? What is it in the publication? And if so, what does that publication look like? Is it an event, a workshop, a conference of some kind that can shed light on a particular topic? And if so, how could we facilitate that? So we're just in the very beginning stages of figuring out what those specific goals are and how we will achieve them. But I'm very hopeful that in the coming years, we'll be able to come up with a research plan and then the dissemination plan for that research, right? How it will be published, how it will be shared in conferences and lectures with a wider audience, and hopefully get a more concrete picture on what that Achaemenid Persian period in Egypt looks like.
And are you able to divulge at this time, something you guys are actively looking at, like a starting point? You know, what's some fun site that you're, interested in looking at, any kind of fun tidbit for us?
Well, I mean, I think the ultimate goal of the project would be to document Hibba's temple that has, now this is a temple out in the middle of Karka Oasis in Egypt's Western Desert. And while it might have been started in the 26th dynasty, it's unclear with those foundations. Excavations have been done, the foundations, the dating of those was a bit unclear. So while it might have been a 26th dynasty beginning construction, it's very obvious that the decorative program was done in the 27th dynasty and primarily by Darius I. And so this is really the only known monument in Egypt that is almost a fully fledged Persian construction. And so it has been published in various ways over the years. Some of the texts have been published in hieroglyphic transcription. Some excavation reports exist. Some surveys have been published. But to try to get really thorough photographic documentation and a full transcription, transliteration, and translation of all texts would be wonderful if we could accomplish that. And like I said, that's probably the most lofty goal of the project. But even, other things include working on the statue of Ujjit-Horesnet, which again has been published widely. Melanie Boxmuth had a special edition volume come out a few years ago just on Ujjit-Horesnet, and obviously a lot of people wrote about this particular statue, including myself. I contributed to the volume. I wrote about this statue. It has been published numerous times, but surprisingly, a full transcription, transliteration, and translation of the statue does not yet exist. And so we're hopeful that we can accomplish that very soon, and especially with the help of graduate student Hong Yu Chen here at UCLA, who's been working on that for quite some time now. I think we can certainly support him with this Achaemenid consortium on finishing that work and getting that published.
Well, I love it. I love the fact that there's resources being created, there's more research being done, there's more ways to support people who want to undertake these things, which I'm sure take years and are quite difficult. So I hope that our audience will be excited to follow along with projects as they develop. Now, I am a bit curious. So since you were one of the first people to work for the, at the time, Portbout Center, and you happen to be an Egyptologist who happens to study later periods, was there always a plan to have the Egyptian consortium, or was this something that happened because they had the good fortune of having you here?
I don't think it was a plan from the very beginning. I think this is something that happened probably because I was hired and expressed interest in contributing intellectually to the Port of Oud, and it seemed like a logical step. But that being said, UCLA does have a strong Egyptology program, and I'm sure the Port of Oud Institute would have capitalized on other colleagues as well, and not just necessarily me. But I think it's important, and I think part of what the Port of Oud Institute is trying to do is to shed light and provide resources to projects like the Egyptian Consortium that are on the fringes of what is traditionally studied, right? To look at the Iranian world more holistically and to incorporate avenues of research that often have been overlooked, I think is one core tenet of the Institute, because it's only by pulling all of these disparate elements together that you're ever going to achieve, a true picture of the ancient Iranian world. You want that full landscape, and you can't do that by having just a laser focus on certain topics while not looking at things like the borderlands, the imperial impress on all of the satrapies, of the Achaemenid Empire, or later into the Sasanian Empire, and then what they do on the fringes of that empire. If you're talking about empire, you've got to look at the whole thing.
I think many people would agree with that. So we've built this beautiful picture, hopefully, so people get a decent understanding of you personally as an Egyptologist, and then sort of what drew you and what things you got to sort of spearhead here at Port of Oud. Now, what I'm hoping to do now is bridge this gap and ask you a little bit about what you do here in your capacity as assistant director at the Port of Oud Institute. And I think from maybe an outside perspective, they'd say, oh, okay, so does all of her work get to be Egypt and Persia, or no? Is that just wishful thinking?
Right. So I'm going to let everyone in on a huge secret that even though I can talk about my research for forever, I don't get to do my research for forever. Right. So as one can imagine, there is a lot of infrastructure involved in keeping a research institute afloat, right? There's a lot of bureaucracy. There's a lot of behind the scenes that has to happen to make everything run. So on a day-to-day basis, and Lexi, you know this because you're right there with me in the trenches, we do a lot of financial record keeping. We do a lot of different types of administrative support when it comes to making sure everything in the offices are running smoothly, when it comes to making sure we're hitting internal deadlines that the university sets for various tasks. All of this has to be done on a day-to-day basis. If it's not, you can forget the conference, you can forget the publication if you don't have a well-oiled machine first and foremost. And so that takes a lot of time, but it's time well spent because nothing else can happen without it. So as you can imagine, there's lots of meetings, there's lots of back and forth between different departments on campus. And when I say departments, I mean not only the academic departments, but also places like payroll and financial management departments and, the purchasing departments. The travel to facilitate people's travel research, can take a lot of time. But again, it's well worth it to, when you see someone actually go off and get to do that summer research project somewhere, they get to visit that museum collection and get that data. And that's what really matters.
Yeah, no, it takes a lot to run a center, definitely. I mean, I think when you start to play around with like official titles, right? If you say, ah, yes, I'm assistant director of XYZ, I think, especially at this level, people are like, oh, so okay, well, maybe even if you can't do that every day, you get to travel a lot and go all over the world and like find the new stuff and then bring it back. So how much travel do you actually get to do?
I mean, again, I'll say not enough, right? That's my selfish answer. But no, I mean, I feel like everyone says that. If you, I don't care what job you have, there's always some element that you'd love to do more of. And I do love to travel. But no, I've been very fortunate. I get to travel to probably several international conferences per year. And some of these conferences we facilitate or help to facilitate, we'll be a co-sponsor of those conferences. Other times it is just me going off to represent the Institute at other conferences and present some of the research that I do. And, I'm always very grateful of these opportunities, and hopefully it does in some way elevate or at least enhance the visibility of the Institute in my own small way. I hope I can contribute to that. And it's a lot of fun.
Well, I think I definitely agree with you. Traveling is very fun, and sadly, we don't get to do enough of it. Well, we can do that when we're retired, and then we can just travel and do personal research to our heart's content, hopefully. But yeah, I mean, so it's you've got a lot to do. So you have this extensive academic training, which you do get to use in certain ways in your job. But as someone who seems very academically focused, it's interesting. I would have assumed, had I not known you, right, that you might have really been dead set on going into a traditional teaching job. So can you maybe explain to our listeners what is sort of the benefit of taking a job like yours versus trying to go the more traditional route and wanting to teach and maybe just do research and work your way up?
Yeah, I mean, one, I think, your traditional professorships are increasingly becoming more difficult to find and to get, right? Departments are always, I was going to say, growing and shrinking, but it seems sadly that shrinking is the more popular trend rather than growing a lot of times. But this position, as an academic administrator, kind of gives you the best of both worlds in that you are able to contribute intellectually to your organization, and you are able to stay in a university system and support the teaching of others and the research for other individuals as well, while at the same time working in almost a management type setting for other aspects of your job. That is very fulfilling, and hopefully, also for me at least, has been a learning experience in and of itself, that I can grow as a person in working on the management skills that I need to support a research institution. And that's been very fulfilling in a way that I didn't necessarily expect at the beginning. At the beginning, I kind of thought, okay, well, I'll pay my dues sort of with this other side of the coin and just be grateful for the time that I do get to do my own research and things. But it's really been, quite an amazing journey to see behind the curtain, right, of a university in a way that you don't as a student. And I think sometimes even faculty necessarily don't get to see the full administrative picture, and to see that and to contribute to that functioning of a university is just very fulfilling, that I get to, in again, in my own small way, kind of make things happen. That's quite fun.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, and I ask because, as we've established, the field of Iranian studies is quite small. We have departments that would support programs like this shrinking all over the world. It's not just a us problem here in the US. And so, for people who do have an interest in Iranian studies or something very interdisciplinary, more interdisciplinary that works in conjunction with Iranian studies, there aren't a lot of jobs, and just opportunity is hard. And so I'm wondering if you found like a good path where it offers kind of this happy milieu, right? Where if you're a young scholar and you're in Iranian studies, but there's no room for you at any departments because just luck, but you want to remain involved and feel like you can contribute in some way without totally leaving academia. I think it's interesting to hear from your perspective what taking a job sort of like yours would do. Do you feel that for young scholars who can't go and study the sites, they can't visit Iran, so they can't see the things that they've been studying. Do you feel that a position like yours is a good alternative for someone who's like, I really want to be in Iranian studies, but I can't get a job?
Absolutely. I mean, I think part of it is to, really put your stamp on any position that you do get, right? So whether it's an academic administration, whether it's in library services, maybe you can work for a publishing house that has, if not, if Iranian studies is too niche of an ask, something in the ancient world, right, in the history line, where you can give your expertise. You know, your years of training do not go to waste in these positions. If anything, what you will do is enhance all of the projects that you're associated with by bringing that expertise. One of the biggest things I think we emphasize to all of the graduate students at UCLA is make yourself marketable. And that doesn't mean not honing in on your specific areas of research. You have to. It means approaching those areas of research with a mentality that this is worthwhile. And I have to present myself in a way where these skills that I acquire are worth something to potential employers. And it's not always easy, it's not always straightforward, but it's entirely doable. And all of these areas that are tangentially related to a university in some way, whether it's publishing, library services, museum studies, all of these different career paths can speak to one's research trajectory and give you the room to continue that research and contribute to the overall intellectual picture. And I think it builds a bridge, right, between you and your colleagues that end up in other institutions elsewhere and other places where maybe you have worked in the past. And those are always important, right? If you can build a bridge between a university and a museum, right, or a university and even a public library somewhere, that is incredibly important. And so to have those types of social connections, you know, through the type of employment that one chooses and the intellectual background that that person has, I think is incredibly important.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. So now I do know that you are not the biggest pop culture movie person. So don't worry, you're not going to get any surprise questions about films you may have potentially not seen. But
yeah, I saw that pop quiz.
but to kind of bring it around and related to certain interests I know you do have, right? So research centers, obviously, they produce research and wonderful resources. But for the, let's call them the layman, right? People like me, maybe, who aren't in the field, don't really know a lot about Iranian studies, but are interested, but not may not necessarily have, you know, a lot of time to just sit down and read every scholarly tome that comes out. In your opinion, like being in the position that you are, you know, where do you kind of want to see in terms of resources that just don't exist yet? What would you like to see a place like Port of Oud do or produce for the general public, you know, something a little more navigable, let's say, that may end up somehow in popular culture, whether that's you produce something, you do something nice, and then someone takes it and says, oh, I want to make a movie out of this thing that they did. Or yeah, what kind of like public outreach things do you think would be good and would you like to see us do?
Gosh, I mean, I really like the bilingual lecture series that we do for the program of Iranian studies, where we have scholars come in and present their research normally in Persian, because the research is normally published in, and this, for some of them, is the only opportunity they have to present their research in Persian. Conversely, and this happens much more rarely, but if a book is published in Persian, we will have them come and present it in English. And that can kind of open up a whole new audience to those that don't read Persian and want to be involved in that scholarly discussion. I really like that model. And now, because we do that for the program of Iranian studies here at UCLA, the topics tend to skew more modern. Right. And that's simply because we have the Port of Oud Institute that covers the ancient world. The program of Iranian studies tends to focus more on the modern world. It's not actually the rule of the program of Iranian studies, but that's just kind of how I think the natural division of labor, let's say, is between these two entities. So I would like to maybe see more bilingual things for the Port of Oud Institute. Now, whether that is expanding the bilingual lecture series that we currently do, but have the Port of Ubud be more involved and become a co-sponsor of that lecture series. That could be one avenue. Something else that we've been talking about for several years, and we really just need to find the time and the resources to do it. But I think primarily it's a time issue, is to look at our online video library that the Port of Ubud Institute has and re-edit our videos so that they have Persian language subtitles and also have English subtitles as well, and perhaps also include a PDF transcription of these lectures. I think that that can go a long way to broadening their usage. They've been incredibly popular with the community. They've been very popular in the classroom. We have a lot of instructors assigning these lecture videos in their various classes. And so I think by including these additional subtitle options, as well as a transcription that makes it more searchable and people can follow along, especially with terms, technical terms that might be, you know, less well known to public audiences, the names and the proper nouns, right, that we use sometimes for the names of kings, the names of places. I think that that would be a huge help for making these a much more popular video. And then, I mean, of course, this podcast, right? I mean, the whole reason why we started this podcast was to have more outreach. And hopefully our listeners really enjoy learning a little bit about the research of the Port of Ubud Institute and the research that the Institute supports. And I know they enjoy listening to you, Lexi. I know that they really like having you as the host of this podcast. But yes, I think doing more things like that.
I think that would be really fun. And now I'm gonna throw in a fun one just because I never get to ask this, but you are really big into music. Now, you know, I'm not gonna sit here and be like, oh yes, you love ancient music, because it's not like we have a ton of it to listen to. But in terms of, like, you know, like pie in the sky, experimental things, like if we could do something, do you think it'd be fun to, like, tie in your interest in music and see, wouldn't it be great if Port of Ubud could sponsor and get some of the top experts in, like, ancient Persian or ancient Near Eastern Mediterranean music all together and then produce something fabulous?
I mean, I would love that. I mean, and I don't think, I mean, on the one hand, that sounds incredibly fanciful, right? And you're like, oh, we couldn't possibly. And topics like ancient music, right? You think to yourself, how can you possibly get at that? You know, it's not, you're never going to find music in the archaeological record, right? It's ephemeral. But practically speaking, there's great studies that have been done on sound and also smell, while we're at it, scent in the ancient world as well. And so I think, yeah, I mean, looking at artistic representations of instruments in the rarer occasions where you do find instruments in the archaeological record, seeing how they would have been constructed, how they would have been played, even looking to modern ethnographic parallels to see, are any of these instruments still used anywhere in the world, and how are they being played today, right? I think that that would be, you know, really interesting. And even reception studies, right? How not necessarily the music itself of the ancient past, but music about the ancient past, or with those themes of the ancient past included in modern lyrics or modern interpretations, modern music videos. A wonderful exhibition was just done by the Rijksmuseum in Odense and Leiden this past spring and summer that was about the reception of ancient Egypt in modern music, primarily in the United States, but also in Europe from about the past 100 years. So jazz, funk, hip hop, looking at how those music styles were influenced by ancient Egyptian themes, iconography, art, fashion. It was an incredibly successful exhibit, incredibly immersed in multimedia. There were so many different ways in which they included the actual music, from listening stations to having the music videos playing, showing the, tangible albums, the vinyl with the decoration, that has these ancient Egyptian motifs, on the album covers, the outfits and costuming that a lot of the artists wore in various music videos or on stage. And so I think just even looking into the reception of the ancient past and how it's portrayed in modern media and in modern music is worth studying.
Yeah. Well, I can't let you go, and I cannot have a podcast episode that sticks out for not having me ask the guest about 300, because it's like a rite of passage. You have to. But also it says something about how undervalued Iranian studies and, like, let's call it respectful portrayals in modern media. I mean, the lack of them shows that, why am I always talking about 300? Because it's the only thing we have, and that's a real problem. But just since, I'm sure you've heard just how terribly inaccurate and kind of offensive it really is. So yeah, that's a problem. So just, in our final couple minutes here, I'm curious to know, what do you think that scholars and even people who are not just like in academia itself, people who work like Portavood research centers, but like, what can we do from this side that helps give people more, I don't know, resources, the means to produce things that aren't so just no words for 300? But what can we do to avoid more 300s?
Yeah, I mean, so I'll say I haven't seen it, but I've seen enough footage, right, to know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, and I think as scholars, to not brush off popularizing one's research, your heavy academic articles, your very dense books, that of course they are important, absolutely. We need to be producing robust scholarship for sure, but also to realize that there is a place for scholarship in popular culture, right? That this isn't about diluting history down to the point where it's simply not true. It's still based in fact. And I think we as scholars need to realize there is a place in the public forum for us and our research, and making it more accessible, including more people in the discussion and dialogue, will correct a lot of the inaccuracies that get perpetuated and make people feel like they are able of taking ownership of a past and representing it proudly. If movie directors or, the writers of these scripts knew, I think, how inaccurate it truly was, they would not move forward with projects like that. They would be upset, I think, and they would possibly even be ashamed to create something that they knew was wildly inaccurate and offensive many times. When you think about these depictions of ancient peoples and thinking that there are groups that do take pride and take ownership in that ancient culture as something that's a part of their history, right? I don't think that would continue to happen. So I think education, public education, is very important, because it will instill a sense of pride in everyone that's part of this dialogue, whether they're scholars, movie makers, artists, the general public, and that's going to create a more realistic and more respected view of the ancient past.
Well, I mean, let's just hope, right, that continues to be maybe trending in the right direction. And yeah, it's interesting. I think if you pitched 300 today, I'm not sure it would get made. You can clearly tell it was made a very long time. Well, not very long, but a while ago. So, it'll be interesting to see. And I hope people are paying attention to, what Hollywood is doing, especially as, you know, more research and more centers and institutes and in other places, and even down to the normal content creator. I mean, there's so many people who have access to like real research and then just produce stuff and put it on YouTube. So there's a billion great ways to contribute, and I hope to see that trend increase.
Yeah, absolutely.
But for most of our conversation, I've been trying to funnel you. I can't tell if you've been able to tell, but I've tried to funnel you to talk a lot about, you know, your research and your role here, because, you know, I want people to come away with a sense that even though you see yourself as kind of, you know, just another cog in the machine to sort of help build the legacy of the Institute, I hope people will take away that you actually have been playing a pretty big role in the legacy of what the Institute will, you know, hopefully be. And so I think there's no better way to end our conversation than with two questions about legacy. And I believe you already know what these questions are, but I'm going to ask anyway. So,
interested in learning more about the wonders of ancient Persia? Visit the UCLA Archaeological Gazetteer of Iran. The Gazetteer digitally preserves famous locations, world heritage sites, and lesser-known areas from all time periods of ancient Iranian history. You can explore using the interactive map, or visit the encyclopedic catalog for updates to the ever-growing list of archaeological sites. Visit www.irangazetteer.ucla.edu and learn more about what the Archaeological Gazetteer of Iran has to offer.
And you can answer this from your perspective as assistant director of Port of Oud, or as a scholar, or both. So the first is, you know, what do you think is the greatest legacy left to us from ancient Persia?
You know, knowing these questions, I should have thought of an answer ahead of time, but I didn't. I really think, you know, especially in the way it relates to my research of how they administered Egypt, I think the greatest legacy is, in the case of the Achaemenids, their ability to govern in a way that was not overtly oppressive. You know, so many times when we think about an empire of the ancient world, right, we think of them as coming in and conquering, vanquishing entire peoples, raising cities to the ground, you know, and essentially just being the villain, right, in this narrative. And, you know, I don't want to paint a picture of rainbows and sunshine here in the ancient world. That happened, right? This was not a wonderful utopia. But from what we can tell administratively, from both Persian and Egyptian evidence, they seem to be very tolerant religiously. They seem to leave local levels of government in place as long as they were functional and as long as they served the greater purpose of the Achaemenid Empire. They seem to leave a lot of autonomy, you know, to local officials, you know, local priesthoods in Egypt. You know, the mercantile class in Egypt could continue to function, the artisans, the craftspeople. And so I think there's something to really take away from that level of permissiveness in allowing local identity to flourish, even in the shadow of empire. Most governments today, I don't think, achieve that nearly as well as the Achaemenids did.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. And you again probably know it's coming, but second question is, what do you think would be the best legacy that we ourselves can leave for future students of Iranian studies?
This might sound a little strange, but I just think good, clean data, right? I don't think, I mean, I always personally say that if you approach a topic saying, I am going to write the last word on this subject, right? I am the authority on this subject, and I am going to proclaim the truth, and that shall be it, and that will be my legacy. If that's the way you approach things, you are wrong. You are wrong from the outset, because number one, the thought that you know it all, right? I don't care who you are as an individual, you don't know it all, and you can benefit from the contributions of others. But two, it kind of implies that you don't think your field of study will progress any further, that new evidence won't come to light, that new excavations won't bring forth new evidence. That's not very hopeful, in my opinion. So I think providing future generations with scholarship that is solid, that provides them with the data that they need to push the field further, right? To take what you have done and be able to reanalyze it, to synthesize it with new material, to work in a collaborative environment with other people in the field and people in other fields, and be able to compare it and contrast it and build upon it. I think that's the most important thing we can do. And that's not to say that we can't draw our own conclusions. Of course we should. We should all have our own interpretations and try to put forth our best possible understanding of the material that we study, but also leave it in a place where future scholars can pick it up and hopefully take it further.
Yeah, that's a new one I haven't heard, so I'm really happy you went there. Yeah, I mean, and also it's a great question because it has no right answer. There are just a lot of possibilities for what we can do. So I do like those unique ones. All right, so I mean, this is kind of a given, but I'm gonna ask it anyway. Where can people find you if they would like to shoot you an email, ask about your research, learn a bit more about the Institute, any of that good stuff?
Right. Well, I mean, start with the PorterVue's website at portervue.ucla.edu, right? I have a faculty profile there. I also have one on the NELF department's website. And my email is Stevens, MA, so STEVENSMA at HUMNET, HUMNET dot UCLA dot EDU. I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone has about the PorterVue Institute, the program of Iranian studies, anything I possibly can about UCLA. I'll do my best, or I'll direct you to where you can get more information. I'm always happy to talk about Iranian studies and Egyptology here on campus. And yeah, I guess that's where they can find me. I'm not big on social media, so I'm sorry if people were hoping for like an Instagram or a TikTok, but email is best. Email is the way to go.
Sounds good. Well, we will make sure that we have several of those things linked in the show notes so people can find you and ask all the questions that they would like. But yeah, I think I hope that people enjoyed, getting to know you a little bit more if they didn't already. And yeah, definitely email Marissa. She's really fun to talk to. So please direct all your questions there.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, yes, of course.
Legacies of Ancient Persia is a Portavood podcast production hosted and edited by Lexi Henning, with select episodes co-hosted by Marissa Stevens. Cover art provided by Hadley Leesman and original music by Brent Arhart. Established in 2017 as the premier research center for the study of ancient Iran, the mission of the Portavood Institute for the Study of the Iranian World is to engage in transformative research on all aspects of Iranian antiquity, including its reception in the medieval and modern periods, by expanding on the traditional domains of old Iranian studies and promoting cross-cultural and interdisciplinary scholarship. Thanks for listening to our show. It's available to stream on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow us on social media at Portavood Institute and at Portavood UCLA, or visit our website, portavood.ucla.edu. If you enjoyed today's episode, please give us a 5-star rating and review us. For podcast inquiries or questions about the Portavood Institute, please email us at portavoodpodcastproduction@gmail.com. We'll see you next time as we continue our deep dive into the legacies of ancient Persia.